This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, head of content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, Anand Venkatramanan, head of ETFs, EMEA, and Robert White, fund manager within our active strategies team. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon, Max.
Well, today we're going to focus on artificial intelligence following the publication of our CIO autumn update, which is absolutely bursting with investment insights on the technology. But before we turn to AI, we should spend a moment to survey markets. Sonia, since we spoke last month, risk assets have continued to weaken as yields have risen further. A new tragic conflict has also broken out in the Middle East. How does all this affect your view of the investment landscape?
Thank you, Max, and a very warm welcome to this episode of our podcast. And let's talk about first things first, the very tragic events in the Middle East. And let's focus on the humanitarian tragedy above all. But obviously, when we look at the implication for markets, we had to witness that other than the impact it had on Israeli assets, as was to be expected, and the oil price to some extent, this has been very much from a pure market point of view, and I can't stress this enough, it is a pure market view, this has not had any broader implications. Now, if you think about it in a broader geopolitical context, and we have talked about this in prior episodes, because we have been very clear that the understanding of geopolitical events and how we consider tail risks in our assessment of investment opportunities has been an ongoing debate ever since the situation in Ukraine with Russia. And as we now see, it's clearly something investors will have to unfortunately get used to, and hence the understanding on how you build scenario analysis around these events, because we have to assume that it might not remain as contained as it seems now. And again, I'm talking about it from the angle, from a market perspective, not from the humanitarian angle. So it hasn't had a big impact. As you rightly say, Max, it has been the higher for longer narrative that has been dominated the markets globally. And it's clear that there's now an understanding that despite the fact that we might have reached peak yields around the world and that we have seen the last of the hikes broadly across most of the major central banks, yields will stay higher for a lot longer than we originally anticipated. And with that, we have seen market pricing reduce their expectations for rate cuts in 2024. Now, this has led to a major repricing at the long end, particularly of most major yield curves. And this leads now to actually a second year of negative returns in global fixed income markets. And now that is historically very unusual and clearly will lead to a rethink in the context of a lot of the themes we have discussed last year in terms of the positive correlation between equities and bonds, and clearly the difficulty that poses to global investors. Now, you pointed out rightly as well that we have seen equity markets reacting. They have actually been very positive year to date, but we have now seen a greater 10% downward move since the beginning of August, but that coincides with a more than 100 basis point move in the 10-year Treasury on the other side. So clearly now equity markets take note, because as we've said during prior episodes, we still believe interest rates work and that eventually they will lead to a slowdown in the global economy. We've actually had European GDP data earlier this morning, and we are seeing a negative print for the third quarter in Europe. So clearly in Europe, the impact has been more direct. As we have highlighted in prior episodes, this is mostly related to the far more direct impact, not only of the geopolitical conflict here in Europe, but because of the direct impact of the energy crisis on European consumers. Now, that leaves the US still as the outlier, and we have seen that third quarter GDP numbers have been, again, very positive. And we are still debating on whether the US can indeed escape the interest rate cycle and whether the policy can lead to the famed soft landing. Now, what is interesting is we are looking at why is the US different? And we have to note that clearly the pandemic has had an impact on economic activity, because we have, during lockdown, consumers have bought a lot of goods because we were locked away, we were a bit bored, and hence bought a lot of goods, which means the immediate impact on the goods cycle was far more subdued than it was on the services sector. And likewise, coming out of the pandemic, we then swapped our behavior and we stopped buying goods, but obviously we're consuming services because we literally tried to make up for all the time that we haven't been able to meet up with friends. That means you had a desynchronized cycle between goods and services, which led to an overall more prolonged cycle, which is reflected in the labor market as well. Whereas obviously services were shedding jobs during the pandemic, there was an increased demand for obviously labor in the services sector coming out of the pandemic, which explains to some extent why the labor market has been so buoyant. Add to it the enormous amount of fiscal stimulus, and you get some of the explanation why we're still finding ourselves in a position of increasing strength. The other question is, how sensitive is the US economy actually? So have we seen a shift in the way how consumers and corporates take out credit? And have we seen a shift towards longer maturities, i.e. the 30-year mortgage, for example, is a far more popular product now in the US, and obviously would mean that consumers are shielded from a dramatic increase in mortgage rates right now. Overall, it might mean that we are seeing a lengthening of the time lag that it takes for interest rates to feed through to the real economy. But to cut a long story short, we stick to our view that we do expect a significant slowdown in the US economy at this beginning of next year. But I thought it's worth highlighting where we have seen extraordinary impacts from what has been clearly a very different cycle to normal based on the pandemic, fiscal stimulus. But it's very important for our investors to differentiate between the longer term geopolitical risk and structural drivers compared to what still is a very dominant short term narrative around rates, inflation, and also the impact on equities. Now, if you look at the S&P 500, it is still positive year to date. But to create hopefully a nice handover to the topic of AI, if you look at the S&P 493, it's flat year to date. And it's been the famous seven stocks, and I'm sure Nvidia will come up in a minute, that have shown 50% plus returns and make up all of the headline return of the S&P 500, which gives you an indication as an investor, understanding those structural trends is a key ingredient in finding the next big investment opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Sonia, for talking through those dynamics and for that excellent segue into the main theme of today's call. It's a great moment to bring Anand into the conversation. Anand, in our CIO Autumn Update, you write that we should expect further surprises from advances in AI amid what already feels like a very rapid pace of change. What does this mean for investors?
Well, thanks for that question, Max. I would say if I were to sort of sum it up all in one word, I would just say it's opportunity, right? I mean, for investors. But of course, you know, it's going to be a journey. We are in very early stages of AI adoption across the globe, across different sectors. So as we kind of tread along that path, there are going to be potholes. We need to kind of watch what's going to work. We need to slice and dice the opportunity set carefully, and again separate the enablers out from users, right? So that's very important. And we did touch upon the aspect of the volume, variety, and velocity of data, and how that kind of feeds into the AI and machine learning models becoming better as they kind of learn from more data. But that said, you know, when it comes to where it's applied and where it's applicable, the beauty or the fascinating thing about AI is that it's across all the sectors, right? From e-commerce to healthcare to cognitive computing to warehouse automation, name it, you know, it's being used. And it's being used across a variety of different aspects, right? Be it text, we would have heard a lot about, you know, ChatGPT in that domain, be it language in the form of NLP, or just being, you know, data processing for business process automation and things like that. So there's plenty that's happening, and we need to kind of carefully look at companies that are actually enablers in this space rather than users of a particular software or a service from some of these AI service providers.
That's really interesting, Anand. So on that point about enablers versus users, what are the subsectors that are at the forefront of the AI ecosystem?
When you look at the sectors that are beneficiaries of AI, I would say it's across the board, right? It's across the board. But when you look at verticals or segments within AI that are actually driving the adoption or the growth, then you can kind of think about healthcare, e-commerce, and within e-commerce, you're talking about factory automation and how these days, how dark and vertical warehouses are actually managing inventory and processing orders in a more efficient manner. And again, in a firm like L&G or any other, you know, financial service industry and so on, business process automation becomes important. And when take an example for insurance company, using AI to detect frauds is a very, you know, fast growing industry, right? So I would say in terms of growth verticals, you're going to be seeing growth being driven by all sectors, but primarily coming from some of what I named. But from an enabler standpoint, you're looking at infrastructure providers, right from NVIDIA and the chip manufacturers. We're kind of looking at GPUs and so on, which are geared towards AI and machine learning applications, or cloud providers, network and security providers, big data analytic companies, and of course, finally, you know, cognitive computing companies, right? So across the board, we feel these would be the key segments that will drive the growth in terms of enablers, but at the same time, as I mentioned, in terms of sectors that could benefit from the adoption of AI, it would be across the board.
Well, thanks, Anand, for that overview. Rob, let's look at the broader market now, and perhaps some of the users as well as the enablers Anand has just discussed. This is something you've written about on the Elgin blog and Madeline King covered in the autumn update. Which industries and what sorts of companies do you think are best placed to benefit, and which are most likely to find their business models profoundly challenged?
Yeah, thanks for that, and thanks for having me along. I think I'm going to start by unashamedly stealing a quote from someone who's pretty well known for his knowledge of the sector. So it's Bill Gates, and he referred to the internet's tidal wave. And he said, changes the rules, it's an incredible opportunity, as well as an incredible challenge. And we think that's a pretty good statement to think about AI and what it means. And just as Anand said, we think its impacts can be broad and deep, and it'll impact all sectors. From an immediate market perspective, what we've seen this year is that we've identified the immediate beneficiaries. Those are the companies who've been directly involved in AI and facilitating its rollout, you know, AKA picks and shovels. The most obvious example of that is NVIDIA, as Sonia mentioned earlier. You know, this is the company which produces the graphic processing units. These are the units which are critical to being able to support that underlying infrastructure and to build these large language models, which are really key to being able to make these AI models as efficient as they are. On the other side, the market's been pretty quick to try and identify who we think the losers are going to be. So that's looking at where these businesses, which for a very long time considered to have deep competitive moats, and where AI potentially fills in some of that. So a really good example we've seen is that Chegg, who's an education service company in the US, and very quickly in Q1 of this year, they acknowledged that they're already starting to see the impact in their homework help services business that had previously been a very defensive type of business, you know, not prone to a huge amount of economic cyclicality and very high barriers to entry around quality of service. And already they're seeing that customers are choosing to use AI software solutions elsewhere. Beyond that, I think it's worth taking a step back and just reminding ourselves how far we've come in the last 12 months. You know, this time last year, I think even for most investors, if you'd asked them what a large language model was, it might have looked at you a little bit blankly. The fact we're now debating around how many billion parameters a large language module needs to be statistically relevant just shows you the industry and the pace we're moving. And it was really ChatGPT, and it's the unprecedented speed of that adoption cycle, which was significant as it really transferred AI, and specifically generative AI, out of the world of academia and into the public, the language of a general population. From a business perspective, it's the socialization of technology, and potentially more importantly, it's consumers demonstrating they're willing to engage with this type of technology that's really been the catalyst of a significant acceleration we've seen in the number of companies who are willing to invest time and resources in really looking to where they can use AI. It's as Nan just said, across all sectors really, whether it's pharma who are using it to be able to accelerate drug pipelines, automotive for driving factory efficiency, or advertising where you're now able to use generative AI to create customer specific advertising. So it's Nike getting Tiger Woods to tell me to buy a new golf club. This is all specific to me and something which, you know, it wasn't really possible before. I think when we look across the companies more broadly, a helpful thing to think about is that in previous tech adoption cycles, what you've seen is that whilst productivity gains have been pretty consistently delivered, where the benefits in terms of margin expansion has accrued hasn't necessarily always been the same. And what you saw was that in the desktop and internet era, you got a pretty broad-based benefit from the rollout of these technologies and margin expansion across all sectors. Whereas in the more recently cloud and mobile, basically because of Magnificent Seven and the stranglehold they have on these types of ecosystems which facilitate that product, you've seen that they've been the beneficiaries in terms of margin expansion, not the broader sector. Our view is that AI offers this ability for all industries and sectors to improve efficiency and the quality of products, and therefore it should look more like the desktop and internet era. We're expecting to see that it's incumbent on companies rather than sectors now to think about how they reposition themselves and what that means in terms of being able to expand their overall margins.
Okay, thanks, Rob. That's a really important perspective on what's being described as another industrial revolution. Bigger picture, how does this impact and affect what you do day to day? I'm thinking, for example, of your use of fundamental research in stock picking.
Put me in a difficult position here. I've got my CIO in the room and I've just told you that it'll impact all sectors. I think the caveat I'm going to apply is that we're definitely still at the very much the R end of the R&D spectrum. And all companies and sectors are thinking about where they can use it. The answer for me is I expect it to develop now going forward over my career, but probably twofold. The first is that you're seeing, similar to other healthcare and the legal professions, huge benefit in terms of the efficiency it brings around being able to process, automate other parts of my job. And why that's important is it frees me up to do more of that second point around fundamental research that you mentioned. From the fundamental research perspective, I mean, I sit, some parts it's a good part of my job and some parts it's quite stressful, but I can have a very sensible conversation, intelligent person on why BP, for instance, is a buy. I can put the phone down and speak to someone else and they'll tell me very sensibly why BP is a sell. And my skill is about interrogating their assumptions and thinking about how they matter. What generative AI does, the ability to be able to get a multiple different views and then me to be able to interrogate those in real time, effectively creating bespoke information around what I want to think about and how I want to analyze the company. So it means that I'm able to be very productive and efficient when I do spend my time trying to understand a problem. So I'm quite excited about the prospect that means for me.
That is exciting. Productivity and efficiency, those are my two takeaways there. Well, Sonia, we've just discussed some of the opportunities and risks that will stem from AI. As a CIO, what about the technology gives you the greatest cause for excitement there and also for concern?
I think I have to look at it from two angles, right? I mean, the first one is what you have just asked Rob, right? What is the implication for us as the asset management industry? And Rob, I think, has been very clear where the use of AI can very much enhance how we think about our investment process. And to put this very simply, whereas fundamental research in the past, a big part of Rob's job would have been to populate spreadsheets and to run the model, I think we are squarely beyond that point, because this is where you have real efficiency, where what you would ask Rob to do is the interpretation, the understanding, and taking the right conclusions from a vast number of data points that will allow us to really move forward and be more efficient and enhance productivity. And that is a big step forward. The asset management industry is not known for being particularly, you know, forward-looking and obviously has been one of the least disrupted industries so far. We should not forget that. And that clearly embracing AI as an enhancer and a tool that will allow us to enhance the investment process and investment outcomes clearly has to be seen as a huge opportunity. But let's not forget it is a massive threat as well, because the industry employs a vast number of people that still would plug in numbers into spreadsheets from balance sheet data and P&L data. So that is a very obvious area where systematic data and AI can help a lot. But the same is true, and this is something Anand said earlier, obviously the writing of RFPs, so text creation, and again, we employ a large number of people that do exactly this, where obviously speed and efficiency will be vastly enhanced if you consider that this can now be done by AI. So these are the two very obvious areas where I believe the industry will benefit greatly, but you have to obviously provide the infrastructure, the platform that allows you to integrate AI in a way that it's not disruptive. And so this is what we will be looking at, and clearly all other industries are looking at. And I would think is a positive, but there's a bit of a not necessarily first move advantage, but you cannot risk to be left behind, because it clearly is now advancing at a pace that requires you to really start thinking about the integration and the way you take it forward. But likewise, as a CIO, in terms of investment opportunities, it's very clear that the market has been very quick in understanding the early winners. NVIDIA opportunity has been priced, obviously tells you that we have to be forward thinking on how this will impact different industries in understanding where we might find the next big winners. And if you think back, then it's clear that for NVIDIA, we might have seen a large part of the forward-looking gains already priced in. That's the way the market works. So betting on what has been the early, you know, winners in this cycle might not be your best bet going forward. And I think this is where the Anand and team come in. It's understanding the life cycle of the adoption and then understand where you will find the winners throughout that period. Likewise, on the threat side, we have to be realistic. There will be losers. And so for the team overall, it's understanding on where the disruption will be most severe and how you can make sure you avoid this. But it clearly is a structural trend that getting it right will be an amazing opportunity for investors to jump on.
Well, thanks. That's a very clear and candid view, I think, there of our industry. Leading a content team, I can agree with you. You know, we are absolutely ripe for disruption there, and the opportunities are exciting as they are scary. As well,
because you will still need what we should not forget, and particularly in the context of the complexity that we've already outlined, we have the whole focus on sustainability and ESG. There's an awful lot that requires forward thinking and understanding and interpreting, where clearly AI again can help, but where you will need the human intervention in order to get it right. But it frees up the time of the people to actually do this and focus on the value add that we believe the human mind can still add to the investment process. That's the key. It's not replacing, it is not, but it is enhancing the process in a way that delivers better outcomes for our clients.
That's absolutely right. Rob, a big story earlier this year that touched on AI was the blockbuster IPO in New York of tech company Arm, which had previously been a UK stock. How big a challenge to the London market is posed by domestic tech companies listing elsewhere?
Yeah, it was clearly disappointing that Arm, who'd been and continue to be a huge success story in the UK tech sector, didn't choose to come back and be listed in the UK. The UK is a market which has a long history of attracting not just the best UK companies, but also the best international companies. It's often forgotten that 70% of FTSE 100 earnings come from overseas, and even what's traditionally thought of as more domestic focused 250 now derives the majority of its earnings from overseas as well. Over years, the UK has been able to attract international businesses for a number of reasons, but also linked to that is its strong governance and reporting standard. And as other listing locations offer less onerous constraints, we've seen that companies, and especially it's these new fast and growing tech companies, have started to look at listing overseas. Addressing that is clearly one of the key reasons why the FCA is currently consulting a range of stakeholders on potential changes to listing rules. Clearly, there's a need to find a close balance now between not having overbearing oversight and the need to support good governance, which we all know breeds shareholder returns over the long term. The other challenge for the UK is the composition of the index. It's still very significantly skewed to the older sectors of energy and basic materials, whilst technology is only about 1.5% of the benchmark, and that compares with the S&P, where it's more than a quarter. That really creates two problems. The first is that you've got an investor base who aren't broadly as comfortable with types of growth companies, and that impacts the prices that they're willing to pay. And second is that, as a consequence of that, structural sector allocations, you've seen that over the last decade especially, fund flows have looked to allocate to indices which are more exposed to these tech growth themes. The combination of that is that you've seen the UK does trade at a significant discount to its international peers, even on a sector-adjusted basis. That creates a problem. It's not just the businesses that want to list here, it's businesses that are listed here. In the last few years, we've seen Ferguson, who's a US-focused distribution company, and CRH, who's an international cement and aggregates business, and they've delisted from the UK and looked to relist over in the US, where they see their peers get more attractive valuations. So, absolutely, broadly speaking, I think it is a clear challenge for the UK market as it seeks to retain its international relevance, but it's one I think needs to be managed carefully over the long term.
Thanks, Rob. You've mentioned the energy sector just now, and Anand, we'd be remiss if we didn't touch on the energy transition today. This, of course, is a related topic where technology plays a huge role. How do you think that higher for longer rates environment that Sonia mentioned earlier might impact investment in clean energy?
Great question, Max. And I'd like to kind of split it up into two parts, right? So on the first one, looking at a rising rate environment and looking at a higher for longer environment, right? When you look at rising rates, that's where you see the trouble for existing, I would say, power producers, because they all have fairly longer term what you call as PPAs or power purchase agreements. And these are basically contracts to sell power at a certain price for a certain period. So clearly when rates go up on a discounted cash flow basis, the valuations come down, and that has a negative impact on the overall, you know, firm's valuation and the stock price. And we've seen that happening. As the rates went up, a number of clean energy stocks did have a bit of a correction. That's one. But on the project financing and the project side, right, particularly for those companies who've just announced new projects and were kind of looking for funding and about to place the orders and so on, and before they actually start building the wind farms or solar farms, if there is rate uncertainty, when the cost of capital uncertainty is there, then that could actually delay, you know, commissioning and development of projects. But higher for longer, that's a different scenario, right? Because now you've removed the uncertainty and you know where the rates are going to be, what your cost of capital is from a project financing perspective. But the good thing there is, as it stands today, wind and solar are the cheapest form of power across the globe. So I would say higher for longer, it might create some short-term aberrations in terms of demand and so on. But at the same time, once the uncertainty in terms of where what the cost of capital is, once that disappears, I would say, given that these are the most, I would say, cheapest form of power, you will see continued capacity build. And that's basically probably one of the reasons why IEA basically came out of the paper recently to say that by 2030, 50% of the global power mix will come from renewable sources.
Well, thanks, Alan. That's really interesting. I should say this is something of a preview to our podcast at the end of November, where Nick Stansbury and Stephen Beer will join Sonia to talk about COP28. It's good to just get in some of those themes now. Well, look, Sonia, we've covered a lot of ground today, as we always do. What are the key takeaways for investors?
I think if you listen to all the content and the topics today, it's very clear, making sure that you look at these in isolation first before trying to add them all up to a big picture and the global narrative. But starting with what Anand has said just now in terms of the adjustment to a higher for longer environment, we have to assume that this is still ongoing, simply for the fact that we had around 15 years to get used to lower rates. and clearly have allowed business models to adjust, return expectations to adjust, valuation levels to adjust, risk premia, liquidity premia. Everything has been adjusting towards an environment where we ended up with 0% interest rates. We have shocked the system with a 12-month hiking cycle. We have to assume that the adjustment to a higher interest rate environment will take longer than 12 months. And I think we are seeing the evidence of how this is feeding through to the system. Public markets will always be faster than private markets. And interestingly, even in public markets, we're looking at an area like high yield. People get very excited around an 8.5-9% yield. But let's not forget, the majority has been from the risk-free rate, not the spread. So we have to make sure investors look at, am I compensated for the risks I'm taking in a context of a much higher risk-free rate and money market funds that pay me 5%? So that is part number one. And with it, obviously, comes the understanding of the economic backdrop and the potential for risk assets to potentially still remain under pressure. So this is what I would still summarize as the short-term narrative and adjustment process in markets. We have started the call, obviously, focusing on the geopolitical situation. And this is something we have been talking continuously, because we very strongly believe that a move towards a multipolar world just has a far higher risk of potential military accidents. And we have to assume that tail risks are part and parcel of the narrative going forward. That means companies will have to adjust and think about what the risk premium is for operating in a specific country. They will have to understand what return requirements they have. And we might still see adjustments towards this new world order and the new normal. And then we've talked about AI as an opportunity set that is a structural force that, again, will have the disruptive power on individual companies and sectors, and clearly provide investors with a huge opportunity set. But obviously, making sure that you avoid potential losers from this trend is as important as finding the next winner. So now you try and build it all together in one big market narrative, and you can see that it is incredibly complex. This is why we always say, point one, prepare, don't predict. Try and make sure we understand what the drivers are between the short, medium, and long term, and where we then can dissect the relevant investment trends that we are that we believe are the right ones to put money behind for the long term.
Well, thank you, Sonia, for the narrative there, for making sense of that quite confused and very fast moving broader markets picture. Well, look, finally, I'd just like to ask what you've all been watching, reading, or listening to recently, as we always do on this call. I'll start off by saying quite late to the party, but I've been watching Borgen, a Danish political drama. It's really fun and just great escapism amid this quite bleak geopolitical backdrop that you mentioned, Sonia. What have you been consuming recently?
After I had two very serious book presentations over the past two podcasts, I thought I should have a slightly more lighthearted suggestion today. On top, I'm a mother of a 10-year-old boy who plays rugby and cricket, and my husband is from India, so I would be scolded at home if I didn't mention that, of course, we're watching the Cricket World Cup. And I should mention, and obviously I'm sitting next to Anand, who will mention the same, because India is on top and is playing fabulously, but we've been watching the rugby as well. And so it's been a lot of sport in my household of late.
Okay, good to know, Anand.
Yeah, I would say the same, right? I think it's an unpardonable offense if I said I'm not watching Cricket World Cup at the moment. So, we're spending all my time watching that, really. It's going good.
Okay, Rob, are you also?
I predictably stopped watching the Cricket World Cup, as the less said about that, the better from my perspective right now. In the meantime, I've just finished Ram Fiennes' autobiography, who's a best known for his polar exploration. It's a fascinating read into a world that I'd love to visit, but I definitely want to explore on my own, as he spent quite a lot of time doing. Really great book.
Good. Well, look, that's a great point, great recommendation on which to end this month's call. Thank you, Sonia, Anand, and Rob, for your time today. And thank you to you, our clients and listeners, for joining us. You can find our CIO Autumn Update on our website and our latest updates via our social media channels on the Elgin blog and, of course, here on Elgin Talks.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2023. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.